Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Catholic Archdiocese of Boston has another public relations problem on its hands. Parochial school parents say they are stunned and outraged because 2 days before school was to end, Archbishop Sean O'Malley changed the locks on the doors to the Our Lady of Presentation Elementary School in Boston last night, fearful that parents would stage a sit-in. The school is on the list of church sites to be closed because of financial problems in the wake of the priest sex abuse scandal, and parents are furious about the lockout.
Oh, devastated about the way they told us. My 8-year-old, my daughter, cried herself to sleep last night. They should have had the decency to allow the children to graduate in style.
That's parent Siobhan McHugh. Here now, reporter Monica Brady-Meyerhoff is outside of the school where I understand, Monica, parents held their own graduation for the kids today.
That's right. They printed up their diplomas, and the pre-K and kindergarten students graduated right here outside. Now a whole other group is gathering for a pizza party to take place in a few minutes.
Well, how much warning did the parents have of the closing yesterday?
None at all, nor did the teachers. They all received a call last night to say that the Archdiocese had changed the locks on the door and they couldn't get back in. And in some cases, parents told me that the representative from the Archdiocese told this to the kids if they answered the phone and said, oh, my mom or dad isn't home. They told them, well, we've and there won't be any graduation.
Well, this is a school that had been fighting a closing. What is the mayor of Boston saying about all of this?
He is outraged. He is just so disappointed. He said he's an Irish Catholic and he cannot believe that this follows with the doctrine of the faith about being good to others and caring for others. He's also offered up Faneuil Hall, the historic hall in downtown Boston, for the sixth graders to graduate tomorrow and hold their graduation ceremony.
Well, is the Archdiocese saying anything as to why they did it this way?
They said that they had information that the parents would stage a sit-in, would occupy the building, and that this was for the safety of the students. That's what they believe. Now, the students, the parents that I spoke to, all have said that they never had planned to stage a sit-in at the building, that they were staging a rally after school closed tomorrow, but they wouldn't do anything to interfere with their kids' special day. They just wanted to watch their 5-year-old, 6-year-old, 7-year-old graduate and have a special moment. And then they did want to protest the closing by holding a rally in the square in front of the school. But everyone I've spoken to here says they never intended to take over the school building, as some Catholics have taken over churches that have been slated for closure.
Well, the Archdiocese of Boston is in serious financial straits, as you've been reporting. More than 80 of 357 parishes are being closed. Other archdioceses around the country are also in financial straits due to large settlements to victims of clergy sex abuse. How are they dealing with these financial problems?
They're dealing in a very similar way. You know, Chicago is closing 23 Catholic elementary schools. St. Louis is closing 8. Boston Archdiocese is closing 9. But the diocese, though, in Spokane, Washington, has filed for bankruptcy. And they've said that, look, we don't own these schools and these churches, so we can't close them and sell them for the profits in order to help pay legal settlements because we don't own them. So there's always this looming question of who does own these schools and these churches.
Yeah, we're keeping an eye on Spokane, Washington, where, they, as you said, they filed that suit. The priests and bishops saying the churches belong to the parishioners there. Well, what are parents saying they're going to do now, Monica?
They are having more protests. This whole week they've got a protest planned in the square, and they have wanted to buy the school building. They said they've made a fair market value offer for the school to turn it into a school and to combine with the library, which is across the street, and the YMCA, which is across the street, to continue to provide programs for kids. And the Archdiocese rejected it. They have said they wanted to turn it into a tribunal building for some of their proceedings. Now, they have just said last night that they are going to reconsider what they're going to do with the building. I don't know whether that means they will look again at a parent's proposal to put their kids, you know, to buy the school. But from what I've heard from parents today, a lot of them are not going to be sending their kids to Catholic school anytime soon. These kids could be absorbed into another school nearby, but many of them said, forget it, we're going to public school. One parent even said to me, forget it, I'm leaving the religion. I don't know where I'm going, but I'm no longer a Catholic as of today.
Well, and just in the few seconds we have, I mean, this is a huge problem But I'm just thinking of the tiny detail. We're heading into summer. Does this mean that these kids can't get their little projects and all the little things that were in their desk to take home?
You're right. They've been completely locked out of the school, which means all of their art projects, their journals that they've kept all year, their school bags, anything they've left in school, they can't go in and get. And this is really devastating to these children who feel so disconnected from their belongings. And the Archdiocese says they will get them to these kids at a later date, but don't specify how or when.
Here now, reporter Monica Brady-Meyeroff. Monica, thank you.
You're welcome.
Now to Iraq. Since the new Iraqi government was announced at the end of April, nearly 900 Iraqis, police, clerics, and ordinary people on the street, have been killed in the spate of shootings and bombings that have engulfed the country. And since the start of war in 2003, 1,684 U.S. soldiers have died. You might remember one soldier we spoke to this past winter just before he was deployed. 36-year-old Sergeant Terry Blogg is a professional soldier. In fact, he's an elite Army Ranger with the Army's 3rd Infantry Division. But he's also a professional ballet dancer with the Columbia City Ballet in South Carolina. And he's now halfway through his year-long tour of duty. Well, he phoned us from Baghdad yesterday on what was supposed to be his day off, if there is such a thing in Baghdad.
I'm calling from one of our base camps here. And right now, they have an internet cafe set up here so guys can keep contact, you know, with family and friends back home. And in the downstairs portion of it, we've got a phone center set up. So right now I'm in a phone booth.
Well, that must be a lifeline for you guys.
Absolutely.
So, of course, we've been thinking about you quite a bit, Terry. We've been reading about all the violence, all the insurgencies.
Yes.
Have you felt the change of pace in your work?
Unfortunately, yes. Particularly after the new government was established, things started to kick off. And, you know, of course, that leaves it for us to deal with out on the street.
Yeah. As much as you can tell us, Terry, what do you do in a day? What's your day like?
it depends on the mission. Like today is supposed to be my day off, but it looks like I'm going to have to go out again in a few hours, which, you know, it's no big deal. You know, I need an extra body out there, and I'm the guy for this one. It depends what we're doing and who we're working with and what we're looking for. Daily patrols can include anything from meeting with members of what they call NAC, Neighborhood Area Councils. My shooters and I, you know, are, of course, security element for convoy going in and out. If we're doing a patrol with the Iraqi forces, a lot of times we leave that, you know, it's their agenda. You know, they're pretty much calling the shots on that one.
I want to stop you there. Are they really? Because, you know, when you say you go out, you know, with these groups, I'm assuming you and your guys are looking for snipers, you know, looking for, you know, to defend against. Do you trust that to the Iraqi forces?
You know, stereotypes exist for a reason, because most of the time they're true. However, having said that, I know what good soldiers are like, and armies are the same all over the world, so are soldiers. And these guys that we're working with, they're good. They're very good. They're competent. You can tell they're, NATO trained, and they have good discipline. You know, I've worked with them now for a couple months, and apart from the language barrier, which is significant, the basics of patrolling don't change. I feel confident walking down the street with these guys.
Yeah. Because I know, you know, how much is at stake. I mean, your lives are at stake and your friends' lives are at stake, and turning that over to another, Army soldier might be tough.
Well, by way of extension, their lives are at stake too.
Yeah. Well, and I know that you have lost some friends.
Yes.
Can you tell us what happened?
That's correct. Well, without getting into specifics, people are either getting blown up here or shot. Mm. And it's either that golden bullet with your name on it, or you're driving down the road, and next thing, I don't know, next thing your vehicle's in a bright ball of flame.
Well, I know that one of the two friends that you lost was a very close friend. And I'm wondering, you know, when something like that happens, how does that shift your perspective?
Well, I try and stay professional about it, but I can't hide the, I try to avoid letting it cloud my judgment. You know, I still have to stay a little bit detached, just to maintain a clear focus on the situation around me and not let my emotions get the best of me. It's hard. You know, you have your memorial service, you have your Jell-O moments by yourself, and then you clean your weapon and, you know, straighten up your kit, dust off all your equipment, and prepare to receive the next mission. And you go out, and you just have to keep moving, you know, one foot in front of the other.
Carefully, because I understand you've had some close calls. You found one unexploded bomb, right?
Of course. I mean, you know, this stuff happens all the time. You know, you drive past an area, and then, you know, a couple minutes later, you hear the boom, and, wow, what was that, you know? Mm. You all look at each other, oh, my God, we just drove right by there. And, you know, you use cover as best you can. You know, don't make yourself an obvious target. You know, when the bullets go whizzing past your head, it makes a very distinctive sound. And that's when you know they're coming at you. And, you know, you just got to be quick and keep thinking on your feet. Don't stall. That's the main thing.
Something, thankfully, you're pretty good at, thinking on your feet. Have you felt, I mean, I don't mean to be flip about this, have you felt your ballet training, you know, come in handy with what you're doing?
That's a tough one. Only to the extent that I'm obsessive about stretching. In fact, right now, I shouldn't even be doing this, but I'm in this phone booth, and I've got my weapon propped in the corner there, and I'm using it as a bar, and I'm stretching over, pulling, you know, stretching on my hamstring right now. because you never know when you're going to have to run. There have been times when, you know, the mission's over, we're on our way home, and then call comes over the radio, all right, change of mission, here we go. You know, and you get out, and you're running for a couple miles through the city, you know, chasing, you know, somebody who did something bad. And that's happened, too.
We're talking about, you know, the ballet. What else do you do for, you know, to get away from war? What do you do?
You know, this is where it probably comes in the most handy. When I'm alone in my bunk at night, I brought my laptop with me, which I never ever thought I would go to war with a computer, but I'm able to play DVDs. And I sit and I'll watch a show. Or I'll listen to, you're going to laugh, but of all things, a class CD, you know, and in my mind I'll go through class, okay, you know, these are Pleiades, these are Tendus, you know, ooh, Petit Allegro, God, I hate Petit Allegro, you know, and on. Now, even though I'm not really doing it in my mind, I am, it puts me in a whole different part of life, and it's my mental escape right here, right now.
That's Sergeant Terry Blagg, a professional soldier and ballet dancer who's currently deployed in Baghdad. By the way, I said he was 36. He's actually 34, although, you know, this experience is probably aging him. We've spoken to Sergeant Blagg before, and we're going to speak to him again when we come back. This is Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We're continuing our conversation with Sergeant Terry Blagg, who's a professional soldier with the Army's 3rd Division. He's now halfway through a year-long tour of duty in Iraq. He phoned us yesterday from Baghdad to tell us what it's really like in Iraq. But Sergeant Blagg is also a professional ballet dancer from South Carolina. Now, before he went to Iraq, he wondered aloud to us what his fellow soldiers might think about that. So yesterday, before he went back out on patrol, I asked him, what did his fellow soldiers think of his dance training?
There's only a handful that really know the deal, and those are the ones that are closest to me. They thought I was lying initially when I told them. They're like, no way. And I'm like, no, really. And usually I tell them, well, you know about my other life, right? And they're like, what do you mean? And I said, well, you know, I'm a professional ballet dancer. Silence. 1001, 1002, 1003. Oh, what? And they just kind of go... they get this really puzzled look on their face. because, you know, I'm their squad leader. You know, I'm supposed to be the see the hill, charge the hill kind of guy, and which at work, you know, that's very much the case. But then people in my line of work here would probably not associate the ballet dancer image with, you know, an infantry squad leader. No way. So it's kind of a giant mental leap for most of them.
But you do lead them in the charge up the hill. You just do a jeté as you go up.
You know, it's funny you should mention that, because the areas where we patrol, there's open sewers everywhere. And I have a really good vertical leap. And sometimes when we're running or when we're going on patrols and stuff, you can either take a long way around or you can jump over them. Well, I've jumped over many, and some of my guys have tried it and were not successful. So that's, their shame is much greater than their pain at that point.
And newfound respect for ballet.
Yeah, that's pretty funny. Because my personal equipment probably weighs about 60 pounds. And this guy, this Iraqi soldier, started leaping across this trench. And all he was carrying was a weapon. And I'm looking at him, and he's kind of daring me, like, just good-natured, you know, competition. And I thought, man, that's going to be close. And he looks at me, he's like, oh, Army Iraq. You know, and in his broken English, he kind of flexes his muscle, and I'm like, and I'm thinking to myself, man, I'm wearing 60 pounds of kit here. And I'm like, oh, hell no, I'm not going to let this guy pump me out. So I just did, I did my best jeté, barely made it, but I made it. And then he just kind of goes, not bad, not bad. And I just gave it everything I had. So, hey,
you.
It worked.
And you know, another thing I want to ask you, do you have interaction with children? I mean, I picture you lining them up to do, you know, leg raises at a bar or something.
The kids, The kids are interesting. They're a unique dilemma. They're naturally curious. They come up. They're friendly. Always wanting, you know. Mister, you know, we learn a few words, but I get tired of defending my Oakleys.
Oh, you mean your sunglasses? People. Your sunglasses.
Oh, yes. They love those things. And, you know, I ask our interpreter, how do you say they're mine? You know, but that's the main thing. But then sometimes, though, I don't know, probably about 50% of the time, as soon as we get ready to leave, a certain portion of them will end up starting to throw rocks at us. Mm-hmm. And then it confuses us because we're like, wait a second. You know, you were just giving me a high five and a thumbs up and, you know, saying America's good, and now you're going to throw rocks at us? So, you know, we end up feeling kind of dejected afterwards, like, wait a second, you know, who's pushing these kids' buttons here to do this kind of stuff? Because obviously somebody is. So, for the most part, they seem to be nice. You know, kids are just kids.
You should do some jetés for them. I'd be so impressed. I want to ask you about something else. The Washington Post and ABC News have done a new poll. For the first time since the war in Iraq started, more than half of Americans think the fight has not made the U.S. any safer. Nearly 6 in 10 Americans say the war is not worth fighting. Your thoughts?
Well, I would have agreed, perhaps, when we first got here, because, well, for two reasons. You know, we were new on the ground, and we were still learning the areas. And I can only speak for my unit, but since we've started working with the Iraqi forces, things have really turned around. They know when people are lying. They know who belongs in the neighborhood. They know who doesn't. It helps out so much that we're working with these guys, and we all seem to be mission-focused in the same direction. So I don't know how that translated into the big-picture politics, but on my level, I see the interaction with with the Iraqi troops to have been a very good thing.
And, Terry, when do you think you'll be able to leave?
You mean go home for good or come home on leave?
I guess go home for good.
Oh, boy. With any luck, probably after New Year's.
Oh, wow.
So,
and what's the first thing you want to do when you get back?
See if my car starts.
Your girlfriend will be thrilled to hear that.
Well, that depends if she can be there. She probably won't even be able to get the day off of work to come see me come in, unless we come in on a weekend. But it'd be good to see her in person, finally.
That's right. Terry, thanks very much.
But of course, it's good to talk to you again.
We will stay in touch. How's that?
Sounds like a plan.
That's Staff Sergeant Terry Blogg. He's an Army Ranger based in Baghdad with the Army's 3rd Division. He and his girlfriend also danced with the Columbia City Ballet in South Carolina. He spoke to us yesterday, just called in, just before he was going back out on patrol. And tomorrow on Here and Now, the Democratic Party works to rebuild its base, but are there problems at the top with DNC leader Howard Dean? Plus, researchers say they're making more progress than ever in the fight against breast cancer. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We thought we'd take a few minutes with the onset of summer to talk about what could be a hot new summer book. It comes from Nick Hornby. Author Nick Hornby is back. He brought us High Fidelity, About a Boy, and Fever Pitch. His new book is called A Long Way Down. In it, he tells the fictional story of 4 would-be suicides who bump into each other on a London rooftop on New Year's Eve and postpone their leap to, among other things, eat pizza. One of them, conveniently, is a pizza delivery boy. Here is Nick reading from the perspective of Jess, a bratty 18-year-old daughter of a British politician.
Long time ago, when I was 8 or 9, I saw this programme on telly about the history of the Beatles. When Ringo joined, you sort of felt this little shiver, because that was it then. That was the 4 of them, and they were ready to go off and be the most famous group in history. Well, that's how I felt when JJ turned up on the roof with his pizzas. I know you'll think, oh, she's just saying that because it sounds good, but I'm not. I knew, honestly. It helped that he looked like a rock star with his hair and his leather jacket and all that, but my feeling wasn't anything to do with music. I just mean that I could tell we needed JJ, and so when he appeared, it felt right. He wasn't Ringo, though. He was more like Paul. Maureen was Ringo, except she wasn't very funny. I was George, except I wasn't shy or spiritual. Martin was John, except he wasn't talented or cool. Thinking about it, maybe we were more like another group with 4 people in it.
That's Nick Hornby reading from his new book, A Long Way Down, and he joins us in the studio. Welcome, and thanks so much for coming in.
Hi.
What a terrific read. Let's keep going through the characters. We heard a little bit from Jess.
Sure.
How about Martin, the first character we meet, a tabloid writer, morning show host, who'd crossed the line he'd drawn?
Well, he has recently come out of prison for having slept with a 15-year-old girl, and he's in, obviously, some disgrace. He's a figure of national fun. His wife and kids have left him, and he feels driven up onto the roof.
And he'd actually said in the past that people who did things like that should be killed,
yes,
or to
exactly.
that effect.
Yeah.
And then you have Maureen, a mother whose only sexual encounter produced a son who is a vegetable. She has one night to kill herself before the authorities realize she has dropped her son off at an institution for good, not just for a one-night visit.
Yeah. She's looking for respite care, and she's kind of conned them into thinking that she's coming back.
Yeah. And we heard about Jess, the 18-year-old. And then JJ, the American who bursts onto the roof with the pizzas. Who's he?
Well, he's been washed up in London because his band's fallen apart, and his English girlfriend has packed him in. And he feels that he's come to the end of the road, in terms of being able to do what he wants to do. And if he can't do what he wants to, he doesn't really want to carry on much.
Right. Well, and anyone who has any delusion that people in this state of mind will appreciate bumping into other like-minded souls, you will be robbed of that in Nick Hornby's new book. They're actually angry. Would you read the passage where JJ, the delivery guy, the pizza delivery guy, surveys the scene on the roof?
And suddenly there I was with 3 potential suicides munching the pizzas I was supposed to deliver and staring at me. They were apparently expecting some kind of Gettysburg address about why their damaged and pointless lives were worth living. It was ironic, really, seeing as I didn't give a f*** whether they jumped or not. I didn't know them from Adam. None of them looked like they were going to add much to the sum total of human achievement. So, I said, great, pizza, a small good thing on a night like this. Raymond Carver, as you probably know, but it was wasted on these guys.
So, the dark side of humanity. I mean, you know, it's been pointed out, Fever Pitch is a memoir. It's about your obsession with British football, you know, what we call soccer. High Fidelity, about a obsession with rock and roll. A fiction, but it's about you, often obsessed with rock and roll. Who and what is Long Way Down all about?
Well, I mean, there are lots of personal connections between me and this book. And the character of JJ, for example, I think I didn't really see until afterwards that I was writing about the way I felt when I was 30, and I really didn't feel as though I was going anywhere at all.
I was going to ask you about that, because at another point, JJ quotes Oscar Wilde. He says, "One's real life so often is the life one does not lead." And then JJ goes on to say, "Yeah, my real life was headlining shows at Wembley and Madison Square Garden and Grammys, and that wasn't the life I was leading, so that's why I could throw it away." Is that the part that might have been a little of you?
Well, when I was 30, you know, I'd been out of college for 6-7 years. I'd hardly made a penny. All my friends had embarked on careers, and some of them were starting to settle down. And it was beginning to frighten me a little that I couldn't see any real way forward, and I didn't want to go back. And so I think that's the situation that JJ's in.
Yeah, and he had this, you know, idea he was going to be a rock star. For you, was it writer or rock star? Because you've been so involved with both scenes.
No, I think one is aware of the talents one doesn't have, at least. And I knew that I didn't have the talent to be a musician at quite an early age. But no, it was writing. It's more the feeling that there's something in that has to come out, and no one's going to let you do it. And I think possibly anyone who's tried to do music or painting or writing, there is this really scary period where people start to pity you, and it starts to look a bit pathetic that you're sticking doggedly to this dream that may never pay off.
Did you think about jumping? Did you ever?
No, I've never thought about jumping, but I'm certainly aware of a corridor in my head that has that door in it. That's all. That's the most I can say about it. It seems to me part of being human.
I have had friends who've taken their lives. It's a terribly painful topic. You, in this book, there's certainly a dollop of that, but there's also hilarity. There's a lot of planning. The JJ character, the one that you said you might have identified with a little, he knows what book he might want to jump with to get it so more people would read it. Which book is that?
Revolutionary Road, Richard Yates. He wants to jump with that.
Well, because?
Because he thinks it's a great book and not enough people have read it, and it might be one bit of good he can do is to promote this book in the act of killing himself.
Is that something Nick Hornby thinks as well, that this is a book more people should read?
I mean, oh, no, Revolutionary Road's an amazing book, yeah.
He also, at another point, thinks about, gee, what would I be playing at this moment if I owned an iPod?
Yes.
Were those your first thoughts? That the songs that came to mind for him, are they the ones that would come to mind for you as well?
No, they were chosen for him and for their absurdity, really. This Jonathan Richman, Abominable Snowman in the Market, and it's just the level of inappropriacy for the moment that I chose for that.
And then The Cure's In Between Days. That's The Cure's In Between Days, referred to in Nick Hornby's new book, which is called A Long Way Down. It tells the story of four very different characters who meet on the roof of a London building where they all plan to commit suicide. Instead, begrudgingly bound by that brotherhood, they set off together to tie up the loose ends of their lives. Listen a little more of The Cure. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, Nick Hornby, suicide is a very serious subject. It's usually spoken about in hushed, reverential tones, but your book smashes at it in some ways. What are you trying to achieve?
First of all, it is a novel which flirts with suicide rather than being about suicide, in that, you know, the darkest part of the book is at the beginning. I suppose, it, you know, to some extent, I'm writing a black comedy, and black comedies tend to be about dark things, but I never feel as though I'm trivialising the issue or poking fun at the people. I mean, I felt kind of in the zone in terms of sympathy. But I think there's always more than one way about writing about something. There are jokes in serious subjects, or you can do it straight. But I don't think it trivialises or lessens the impact of the issues.
One reviewer, I'm paraphrasing, in the New York Times said, you're known for looking at that little detail that people don't think to write about, because why is that important? I wouldn't have thought that someone would think about what to listen to on their iPod when they're thinking about suicide.
Yeah, well, the thing about suicide or death is that actually it takes place in the here and now. It's not an abstract. And so, yes, when you're up on the roof, you've got change in your pocket, you've got your mobile phone ringing or not ringing, you've maybe got, you know, a broken pen leaking into your jacket. All these things will be going on, and those are the details that you're kind of looking for to ground it all.
Or you've got a strange woman tapping you on the shoulder saying, excuse me, are you going to be long with that ladder?
Yeah.
Because I need it.
It was something I spent quite a long time thinking about, you know, that they actually stop you from jumping in these places. So Martin has remembered to bring with him stepladder and wire cutters so he can climb over onto a ledge, and poor Maureen, who hadn't planned that carefully, is very much relying on his tools, so she needs him to get a move on.
It happens as well when you make JJ bump up against these other characters, he looks at the group up there and he says, wait a minute, suicide wasn't invented for people like this. It was invented for people like Virginia Woolf and Nick Drake, the singer, and me. It was supposed to be cool.
Well, that's the rock and roll perspective, isn't it? That people who died young have this sheen about them. And I think, you know, that this character is attracted to that in a way that maybe a lot of young people are, in terms of their devotion to those particular stars, and Kurt Cobain, obviously. And, and he gets up on the roof and he looks at these people and, you know, you've got this very shabby breakfast television presenter and this poor mother and this deranged kid, and he thinks, oh, yeah, this really isn't as cool as I thought it might be.
And we don't want to give away the ending, but there's a quote in the beginning about happiness.
Yeah. The only cure for unhappiness is happiness. I don't care what anyone says.
Right. Who says that?
It's a writer called Elizabeth McCracken in a wonderful novel called Niagara Falls All Over Again. I mean, I think it's not giving away anything to say that they all four live. That's kind of made clear right at the beginning of the book. They're kind of working towards a place where there's a platform for them. And I wouldn't say that that's anything like a happy ending, but I would say that there's a possibility that they might survive for a few more pages after the end of the novel.
And then they're on their own.
Yeah.
Right. Well, finally, since we're here in Boston, we have to ask you about the movie Fever Pitch,
uh-huh,
taken from, your novel, but there was another movie version.
Yes, and, it's complicated genesis.
Yeah, it stars Jimmy Fallon as a diehard Red Sox fan. This was your memoir, and you were a soccer fan. Your thoughts on the movie?
Oh, I loved it. I think it's a really sweet movie, and has a lot of charm.
And then there's High Fidelity, Jack Black, you know, the insane
I'm very proud of helping to launch Jack Black's career.
Well, you should be. But now in reading this book, are you thinking cinematically when you write?
Well, it's funny because when I wrote this book, one of the images I had in mind was four characters standing on a stage. It's probably as internal as all the other books have been. But having said that, Johnny Depp's bought the movie rights, so I guess it will be a movie at some stage.
Fame is but a fruit tree, so very unsound. It can never flourish till its stalk is in the ground.
Author Nick Hornby speaking about his new novel. It's called A Long Way Down. And by the way, that is the late Nick Drake singing Fruit Tree. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
Far from their dying day.
I'm I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and all eyes in the horse racing world will be on the Belmont Stakes in New York this weekend. It's the third jewel in the Triple Crown. Jerry Bailey will be jockeying AP Arrow. Bailey is at the height of his professional career, but the road has been a bumpy one. Bailey writes about the daunting obstacles he's overcome in his book, Against the Odds. Early in his book, Bailey writes that he once doubted he'd ever ride in a Triple Crown race. He explained why to Bill Littlefield, host of the National Public Radio program, Only a Game.
I started in New Mexico. West Texas, where I grew up, was very close to a New Mexico track, and it was at best a C-caliber track, and those kind of things just didn't go through my mind at that period of time.
You're very candid about your alcoholism in Against the Odds. To what extent was discussing your disease the motivation for writing the book?
Well, in 1997, I believe it was, Bill Knack of Sports Illustrated did an in-depth article chronicling my alcoholism, and I had a tremendous response from people across America in various ways. I mean, people that were struggling to stop drinking, people that had already stopped drinking, and people that were in the midst of it and went back. And I knew right then that there was a lot of people suffering from the same thing I was, and I wanted to go in-depth and reach as many people as I could, and I wanted to write a book at that point. My schedule just didn't permit it, so as soon as my work schedule slowed down enough for me to get this thing done, I did it.
In one of my favorite contentions in your book, you write of former Horse of the Year Cigar, upon whose back you were spectacularly successful, quote, "He was smarter than I was." Would most successful jockeys acknowledge that about the best horses they ride?
Maybe not. It's one thing that recovery has taught me is to be brutally honest with first myself, and then I think it transcends to everybody else. And I think knowing that in every aspect of my life, I've tried to be as forthcoming as possible. And there's a lot of instances where I think the horses that we're on know how they want to run best. And if we, in fact, we are honest, we'll acknowledge that.
Well, speaking of how smart the horses are, you've got an interesting situation in this Belmont Stakes. You're riding AP Arrow, a 20-to-1 shot. Do you know, are you familiar enough with AP Arrow to know how smart this horse is?
No, I know what I see on a past performance sheet. But to be quite honest with you, horses run best the way they want to run, as I just alluded to. And sometimes the first time you're on them, that's the way you ride them, the way they want to run, because you have no preconceived ideas other than what you see on the past performance sheet. So sometimes that's the best time to ride them.
I wonder if the way things shook out in the Kentucky Derby, if it's just a fine thing to be riding a 20-to-1 shot, the Belmont Stakes.
Well, you know, that and plus the recent history of the Belmont Stakes, a lot of long shots have won it. So, listen, after 1993, when I won the Breeders' Cup Classic, which was the richest race in America, aboard a 99-to-1 shot, I thought anything's possible.
You know, I'm not quite sure why I'm asking you these questions, Jerry, because you wrote in your book, and you have said many times in interviews, that jockeys are terrible handicappers. Maybe we shouldn't even ask who's going to win the race.
Well, the point I try and make is I'm a very good handicapper to the top of the stretch. That's all I try and do is map the race out to the top of the stretch, because if I'm on a live horse and he's competitive by then, there's not too many decisions to be made after that. And if I'm not and he's trailing the field, there's not any decisions to be made at all. So that's pretty much how I handicap it, not to the wire, but to the top of the stretch.
That may be one of the things that surprises readers of your book who are not necessarily real familiar with horse racing. The number of times a jockey finds himself saying at some point in the race, hey, I could be the greatest jockey in the world. This horse just doesn't have it. I'm going to relax.
Yeah, that's true. I cannot make a horse win that's incapable of it. It's just simply not going to happen. But a bad ride can get a good horse beat, and I try to make that distinction.
A lot of the latter part of your book deals with ways that the lot of the jockey could be improved. You support better medical insurance, better pension programs for jockeys. You'd like to see a more sensible weight system for jockeys so they don't have to get down so light. How likely is it that those who run the industry will one day see these issues as you do?
Well, I think it's already happening. The weights are in process of being raised. The insurance issue is being addressed as we speak, and a lot of tracks have already upped the on-track accident insurance from $100,000 to $1 million. I just think that the jockeys can be so much better utilized, not only if you take care of them and do the right thing as far as their working conditions, but if you utilize them in a promotional way, mm-hmm. just so, as much as the NBA did Larry Bird and Magic Johnson in the early 80s, and that industry just went through the roof. So I think there's a lot of ways. You know, there's so many aspects of this industry that makes it work, but unfortunately all the public sees in front of them are the horse and the jockey. Having said that, I think that since the horse can't talk, the jockey is the one element out there in front of the public routinely that they can relate to, and I think the industry needs to utilize that.
But does a jockey have to become very rich and very successful to be able to risk advocating changes in the game?
I think that's some of the fuse that the industry might pick up and listen to, unfortunately.
Of the most famous and celebrated of thoroughbred races, the Kentucky Derby, you write in your book, quote, "The Derby affirms life itself." That's quite an assertion. Okay, but how about the Belmont Stakes?
Well, it's the cherry on top of the ice cream sundae. You know, if you can get this far and have a chance to win it, in and of itself, it's not as important in the laypersons, the non-racing fan. It's not as important in their mind as the Derby or the Preakness, but if you've won those two, then it becomes more important.
Jerry Bailey has won the Eclipse Award as the nation's top jockey in 7 of the last 9 years. He spoke to me from the jockey's room at Belmont Park. Thank you very much, Jerry.
Thanks, Bill.
And Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game, joins us now here in the studio because, Bill, in the couple minutes we have, how about handicapping this weekend's race for us?
It's impossible. It can't be done. I mean, the popular way of talking about the Belmont Stakes this year is 2-horse race and then a whole bunch of garbage. The only problem with that is one of those pieces of garbage from the Kentucky Derby won it.
That's right.
At a very long price, Giacomo, and so he's no longer garbage. He's all of a sudden one of the favorites for the Belmont Stakes, and that's the way the game works.
Right, but they are saying that the 2-horse race is a Fleet Alex. Mm-hmm. Actually, they're saying he's the horse to beat in this race. He won the Preakness after stumbling early on. Everybody embraces this horse. And then you mentioned Giacomo from the Kentucky Derby, but let's go to a Fleet Alex. Is he the favorite?
Well, I think he's certainly got to be the favorite based on the Preakness performance. Not only did he finish first, but he finished first after the kind of stumble that would have taken most horses out of the race. So it's now the common knowledge from the jockey on down is this is the most athletic horse who's ever lived. He can practically fall to his knees and still get up and beat the best horses in the country and win the Preakness. So, yeah, he's a big favorite. And racing loves a super horse. And getting up off your knees to win is the beginning of the qualification for the designation super horse. Right. So, yeah.
And people love a good story. A Fleet Alex, just briefly, there was a young girl named Alex who had cancer. She started a lemonade stand to raise money for cancer. She unfortunately died, but she lives on through lemonade stands that you can buy and raise money. And the people who embrace this horse also love this girl. So there's a little bit of that kind of, horse track mythology and real good story around this horse.
As there have been for several horses recently. Go back to the last couple of years, Smarty Jones et al.
Right. Well, and what about Giacomo's chances?
Well, you know, this is the Belmont Stakes. The last several years have seen huge long shots come out of nowhere to win the Belmont Stakes. So why don't we go with Jerry Bailey? What the heck? He was very nice to talk to us on a morning close to the race. Why don't we go with his 20-to-1 shot?
That's how I bet when I think about betting, which I don't do. His horse again?
AP Arrow, trained by Dwayne Lucas, top-of-the-line trainer. Jerry Bailey, obviously top-of-the-line jockey. What the heck? It's a long-shots race. Anything can happen.
Okay. You heard it from Bill Littlefield of NPR's Only a Game. Bill, thanks so much. Catch you this weekend.
Thank you, Robin.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.